Welcome into the Ether, a podcast focusing on all things Ethereum, the leading blockchain for decentralized applications. I'm Eric Connor, your host and founder of ETHHub, a decentralized information hub for Ethereum. Into the Ether features deep dives on topics with prominent guests in the community, as well as ETHHub weekly recaps featuring Anthony Sassano. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the ETHHub weekly recap. On these episodes, we discuss the latest news from the Ethereum ecosystem and crypto space as a whole. This week, we are discussing the news from April 22nd to April 28th. Hey, Anthony, you want to walk us through the news?
Hey, Eric. Sure. So we posted a announcement post. How long ago was it since recording? I think it's just 12 hours ago about the ETHHub community and forum call. It wasn't included in the newsletter, but it's on all our social channels. So if you go one of our Twitter profiles or ETHHub's Twitter account, you'll be able to see it there, or our Medium page. So yeah, it's just got all the details for what we expect to the community forum to be and what the call to be. So the first call will be next week, May 7th at 1400 UTC. We tried to find a time zone that kind of fit everyone. It's quite hard, like especially for me down in Australia. It was quite hard to find a time that fit. It doesn't exactly work. I have to kind of like work around it, but it was the best time zone for everyone else. And you know, we kind of looked at where a lot of the people are situated. Most people are in the US and Europe and a little bit of Asia too. Not so much down in Australia. The community here is actually quite small. But you can always, rewatch it because we'll be recording the call, of course. Unless you're actually speaking on the call, watching it live probably doesn't really matter too much. Of course, you'd be able to be in the chat and ask questions and things like that. But that's why I've got the forum, because the forum, accommodates for different time zones and things like that. So yeah, go read the blog post let us know what you think. We're open to changing things if the community feels that they should be changed. We're not trying to dictate how this kind of thing should be run. It's just that we have to start from somewhere. And, you know, it's better to start off a little bit more centralized with it, because then we have some control over various things, rather than trying to decentralize it completely and then just get stuck with people just, you know, talking over each other or getting stuck in talking hell, basically, where nothing ever gets done. So yeah, look forward to that next week. The second thing, just quickly, Chaz Schmidt, our core contributor to ETHHub, announced his new blog series this week called EGS Garage with Chaz. So this is run as part of the ETH Gas Station kind of network, which is now part of the Concourse Open Community. So the new blog series will follow Chaz on his journey on taking some dApp ideas that he's had and turning them into reality, basically, which is kind of really cool because we don't get to usually see this like dev life cycle of these little apps. Imagine seeing like a dev life cycle of Uniswap and, you know, from idea to execution and all the trials and tribulations. That would have been really cool. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to reading this blog post from Chaz, this series from Chaz going forward.
Yeah, definitely. It seems like a cool idea. I kind of watched someone walk through like trying to develop on Ethereum. So I'm looking forward to it. And, you know, obviously Chaz is a big contributor to ETHHub and a friend of ours. So I'm excited to kind of check this out. And obviously big fan of ETH Gas Station too. One of my most used tools throughout the year, maybe potentially the most used tool for me over the last 2 years in Ethereum.
Yeah, I use it a lot too. I use the Chrome extension as well. It gives you a nice little indicator of the current fees on Ethereum, which is really cool. Cool. So into the news, we got Tether drama again. So this kind of blew up during the week. Quick TLDR was that Tether kind of had $850 million worth of funds frozen by a kind of, I guess, a dodgy bank. And then the New York Attorney General's office is suing them because of this. Because what they did was they actually printed tethers to cover this shortfall, which is quite funny because people have been saying for a long time that Tether and Bitfinex have been kind of printing money out of thin air. It's not 100% backed because there's never been audits or anything like that. It was really funny to see reactions around this, actually, because I've noticed a lot of one particular community, mostly from what I've seen, the Bitcoiners are defending this because they kind of perceive Tether as integral to Bitcoin for some reason. It's reflected in the markets, of course, but I don't know. I kind of feel like this drama, even if Tether and Bitfinex were to go away, it's like Mt. Gox going away. It's not a death knell for Bitcoin at all. But yeah, it's just a bunch of weird reactions. And then, you know, it came out this morning. I didn't include it in the newsletter, but it came out that Tether's only, I think, 74% backed by cash or something, which is, you know, just feeding the mob some more, because, you know, people have been saying for years that Tether isn't fully backed. So yeah, I don't know when this drama is going to stop. It's just like the gift that keeps on giving, really.
Yeah, I guess the only time this is ever going to stop is, you know, as competitors start to take them over. I mean, yeah, the Tether drama has been going for years now. It's exhausting. I mean, yeah, we've talked in the past, or at least I know I've tweeted in the past, that the biggest risk for Tether were funds being frozen, right? And that's what happened here. I mean, I don't think they were being outright malicious at the start, but anytime you're kind of getting into this shady, like, gray area, as far as like managing funds like this across different countries and bank accounts, like, the odds are a government is probably going to try and freeze them and seize them at a point. I've said I thought it makes no sense to me that Tether trades one-to-one to the US dollar because of this freeze slash, I guess you could kind of call it like credit risk, or default risk almost. I mean, Tether should have always been trading under the peg. So obviously that's relatively manipulated. And I guess now they're saying that only 76% of their treasury is actually cash and the rest are in quote unquote other investment vehicles. Now, to be completely fair, if you actually read the USDC, so the Coinbase and Circle stablecoin that they use, the terms are actually extremely similar. So it says that, you know, it can be backed by US dollars or cash equivalents. Now, what cash equivalents are is kind of up for debate, right? I guess. And I don't know if, you know, Coinbase and Circle are 100% backed by cash, or if they have some other investments in there. Kind of, and, you know, now we're finding out that Tether has other investments in there. I do know I looked at Gemini because they have their own coin, and their recent audit showed that it is actually 100% backed by cash and not any other investments in there. But, you know, this kind of goes with, I'm not interested at all in centralized stablecoins. I find them kind of relatively boring. You know, DAI is still where it's at for me as far as stablecoin goes and where the innovation is. So I think, you know, we need to just learn that just because it's a stable coin on crypto doesn't mean that we're going to get rid of like the problems that can exist in the typical centralized, you know, worldwide banking system, right? And I think we're seeing that firsthand with Tether. And I think eventually we're going to notice that most of these centralized stable coins are going to run fractional reserves and eventually almost just turn into banks where they're using customers' funds to earn interest and kind of getting into other investment vehicles as well, because they don't think there's going to be a run on the bank where they need, you know, 100% of the cash at any given time. So it'd be interesting to see. I mean, hopefully Tether just slowly dies out, but it seems to never go away.
Yeah, it's quite funny. You mentioned the other stable coins as well and how they all have their own little intricacies and kind of, I guess, backdoors, if you will, in some of them, except DAI, of course. But then we've got a problem with DAI where it loses its peg because the maker system isn't a stable coin system first. It's a kind of like a credit system first. So yeah, I am definitely with you. I'm more interested in the decentralized stable coins like DAI and a few of the others coming down the pipeline, I guess. But yeah, these fiat-backed coins, I mean, they serve a purpose, but and I much prefer the ones like Gemini and Coinbase, the ones that I know are more trustworthy than something like Tether. But I personally don't use them. I tend to use DAI, you know, dog fooding and all that. But yeah, so I hope that this Tether and Bitfinex drama eventually kind of goes away. I feel like the only way it goes away is, as you said, these other stable coins chip away at its dominance, or Tether or Bitfinex go out of business, which I highly doubt that's going to happen. Maybe Bitfinex one day unwinds Tether, but I imagine it's quite a lucrative business for them, you know, depending on how they actually work in the background, because the whole process of Tether is completely opaque. No one really knows, you know, what the process is. But, you know, if they've been doing it for this long, I suspect that it's very, very, very profitable for the exchange. So moving on from that one, one more piece of news I wanted to talk about was Samsung announced that they're developing an Ethereum-based blockchain this week. Now, this is really cool. This is just another one of these enterprise big companies working with Ethereum, basically. We've seen, you know, a lot in the past. We've seen rumors of Facebook working on a stablecoin project. We've seen JP Morgan working with Ethereum for a long time, actually using their own fork of Geth called Quorum. So yeah, Samsung kind of jumps into this game basically and says, we're developing an Ethereum-based blockchain. It's going to be private at first. They're going to play around with it in their own sandbox. They've envisioned that they may eventually connect it to the public chain eventually. And they also may create a Samsung coin. So, you know, they're doing the whole thing, right? They're doing what most of the people in this space are doing. They're creating something. They might issue their own token or something like that and integrating it with public Ethereum. You know, it's just another thing that's being built on public Ethereum at the end of the day. And the fact that these big companies are choosing Ethereum means that, you know, it validates what we're saying, that Ethereum is the most mature and far along platform to build on. You know, there are a few other platforms, I guess, that have different companies building on it. Like I know, you know, Stellar has IBM, but I mean, that to me is just noise. Where the real innovation, you know, and work is happening is definitely on the public Ethereum chain. Even if these companies build private first, they can definitely bridge to public Ethereum or put their implementation on public Ethereum. We're seeing that with like EY, the auditing firm that we talked about, I think it was last week or the week before, where they're just basically gone all in on the open network and they're open sourcing everything. They're doing private transactions. They're just doing everything. So it's really awesome to see that Samsung is now joining the fray. And I expect this to keep happening. Like, I don't expect these big companies to sit on, you know, their hands and say, hey, what's this blockchain thing? Let's ignore it because of whatever they've heard, basically. No, they're definitely, I feel like most companies are experimenting with this. Even companies like Apple and Google are definitely experimenting with this behind closed doors. And we're going to see more come from these companies as time goes on.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it seems to be a trend, right? JPM, EY, Samsung. I mean, there's so many. I don't really know, I guess, what the plan's going to be for Samsung. That seems to be a little quieter. But yeah, I mean, the obvious, I guess, first shift would be like a Samsung coin to use maybe within their app ecosystem, their app store, Samsung Pay. Again, like I'm a bit burnt out on this whole like everybody create their own stablecoin thing, but you know, it's adoption, so I'll take it. I think I totally agree that I think a lot of these companies will start on the private side, but then it'll be a natural evolution to move into interopting through the public chain, right? So potentially stay on a private chain for customer privacy until we kind of get some of these better zero knowledge privacy solutions out there and then kind of transition more strongly onto the public side. But yeah, I mean, I guess when Samsung launched the Galaxy with the wallet and Ether was like kind of the first and only coin that they supported, I suppose that hinted at this, but it'll be interesting to see. I'm excited to see. We've got all this news now about some of these larger companies starting to at least experiment and build on, you know, EY is on the public chain, JPM and Samsung, it appears maybe it might start private. I'll be interested to see what they actually want to build and how they want to integrate it into their apps beyond just having a stable coin, right? So that to me is what I'm going to be most excited to watch about this.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like it might take a little while for something to pop out, especially because we've discussed before that the public Ethereum chain isn't ready for mass adoption just yet. It's getting there with layer 2 tech, with ETH 1.x upgrades, and of course ETH 2.0. But yeah, as we said, I think we said when Facebook, the rumors of Facebook coin was announced, that if Facebook launched their stablecoin on Ethereum, it would you know, bring the network to a crawl and they'd be paying a crap ton in fees just to service you know, that use case. So definitely looking for more of this stuff to go online once we've got more standardized scaling solutions, basically live on mainnet. So on to project updates. First big one, Uniswap News. They formed a company and they got funding. This was really cool to see. I met Hayden Adams, the founder of Uniswap, at EdCon. He was very excited, you know, about all the things he had planned for Uniswap and everything. And it's really great to see that they were able to secure funding from Paradigm, which is founded by Charlie Noyes and Coinbase's co-founder, Fred Ersam. They gave Uniswap a $1 million seed round, and they're basically the sole investor. So, you know, that was actually quite cool to see, because I imagine that a lot of investors, funds, VCs would have actually been contacting Uniswap about a way to invest, because as you know, Uniswap doesn't have a token. The only real way to invest in Uniswap is either to buy ETH, so you're investing in the underlying technology, or become like a kind of liquidity pool on Uniswap and then earn, you know, profits that way. But that's not really investing in Uniswap, if you will. So yeah, I'm wondering what, you know, whether it was Uniswap's decision to have just a sole investor, or, you know, Paradigm really wanted to just be the sole investor and work very closely with Uniswap on integrating new features and things like that. But yeah, so yeah, because of this new funding, Hayden's been able to hire two full-time people as well to work on Uniswap with him. And he's got a lot of big plans. I linked the tweet announcement thread in the newsletter, so you can go check that out and see what his near-term plans are. But you know, my impression from meeting him at EdCon is he's very motivated, very driven. He is very, very happy, of course, with how Uniswap has been received and how it blew up so much. And I think that's motivated him some more. Of course, we feel that with EthHub, you know, nothing like something getting popular to motivate you to keep working on it. So yeah, congrats, Hayden. You know, all the best for the future. If you're listening to the podcast, we should be able to have Hayden on soon enough, you know, to talk Uniswap and to talk this new endeavor on Into the Ether. So, you know, keep an ear out for that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, huge fan of Uniswap, obviously, and the idea in general. And I think what I'm most excited about here is just seeing that, you know, a team that, to be completely blunt, doesn't have a monetization strategy at this moment, still being able to raise some seed funding, right? So I think a lot of the concern in the community around funding now, maybe misguided is a strong word, but I do think, you know, traditional avenues of raising funding once you have an application and a good idea are still possible, right? We don't need to do everything through kind of this decentralized structure of DAOs or block rewards or whatever you might call it. So I think if you have a good idea, you can prove you have a strong user base and you have future growth. I mean, that's how traditional companies start, right? They're all losing money. They don't have a path to monetizing that. They raise funds and then they kind of go from there. So the fact that they can hire two full-time people now, I'm sure will give them a lot of relief as far as developing new features and stuff. I will be very interested to see where they go as far as kind of monetization. Maybe that doesn't come into play for a couple of years, but you know, I've said in the past kind of to some of the Uniswap folks on and Twitter or just random conversations that have been out there about Uniswap, I do think there's a market for kind of selling, you know, more pro features for things like this. So Uniswap, if you go to it, is very like simple UX, right? Well, there's probably some kind of pro traders or pro liquidity providers that would be willing to pay for a little more features, or at least more stats, right? Just because it's open source doesn't necessarily mean that you can't have like a pro side to this or offer some kind of benefit to people that are willing to pay like a small monthly subscription or something. So I'll definitely be interested to see how they plan to do that. And that's a very common theme, I think, for a lot of the kind of decentralized applications out there right now, because, you know, they're open source and people fear that if they put in some kind of monetization plan, they're going to be forked. But, you know, I disagree with that. I think if you have a strong team and you already have a large network effect, it's going to be very hard to just, you know, fork out a little bit of monetization play. Because in all reality, I think people have started to realize that these teams need to be funded. So I think as they start to explore that more, I don't really think there's going to be much pushback there.
Yeah, there's definitely a difference between forking out a token that people perceive to be useless and forking out a kind of community or network effects. We see this happen a lot where, you know, people want to fork a chain. I mean, the classic example is Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash, and, you know, you can't fork the community. You can of course, fork the chain and create your own currency and whatever, but then the community isn't going to follow that, basically. So it also goes to, like, a few people saying, hey, we should fork Maker. You know, remove the token and, you know, do whatever from there. I don't know if that would work, because all the network effects is on Maker. Like, all the ETH that's locked up is in Maker. You're not forking that. You're just forking the code. So, yeah. And it also speaks to 0x as well, like how DDEX forked out the token. DDEX had the network effects. They had like over 50% of the trading on 0x. So they thought, hey, you know, why do we need to have the 0x token integrated in this when we can? I mean, I think they use their own token, but, you know, they can use their own token or no token at all and still retain those network effects. So it's definitely a balance. I think with Uniswap, as you said, it'd be very hard to fork out these premium features because it's not really, I guess, a token. It's more of a convenience feature and more of a value add from Uniswap itself. And Uniswap is always going to remain free because it's just a bunch of smart contracts on the Ethereum blockchain. Not free, but you get what I'm saying, right? It's not going to be paywalled, or you're not going to have to use some premium feature to use the underlying raw technology there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, they developed smart contracts like a lot of these platforms have, but I think, you know, I actually believe we're going to see a pretty big push to where potentially even just using a UI on top of the application will require some type of small fee, right? Because that's where, yeah, sure, the contracts are out there and anybody can interact with them, but creating a good user experience is probably the biggest value add a lot of these teams could do after the contracts are already deployed. That doesn't mean like people have to pay $100 a year to use the UI, right? It could just be that a very small cut of every trade that is done through this user interface potentially goes to the team, right? So I think I still am a bit shocked that this these monetization plays haven't happened a bit more by some of these teams, but I think we'll see it in the near future.
Yeah, I saw a funny post that people build a DeFi app and then realize they need users. So, you know, they start trying to do whatever to get users. We saw this with Dharma, of course. They're subsidizing the various loans so they can offer high rates to get users, which is a smart way to go about it. But yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think the key is like, if you kind of just not hide it, but just put it in from the start, people don't really care or know, right? So the classic example is Ether Delta. They were charging a 0.3% trade fee forever, and people just didn't care because they offered a good product that people wanted. Well, good's debatable, but they offered a market niche product that people wanted, and it enabled some trading of things that people weren't able to do on centralized exchanges. Once it's kind of there and just accepted as part of the platform, you know, I don't think it's really the end of the world.
Yeah, Ether Delta was like the OG shitcoin token trading platform, like DEX, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And everybody was like, oh, if you put a fee in there, people are going to fork it. Well, that never happened. And the guy that wrote that, I mean, it's public. You can see how much fees went into the fee contract, but he made hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, I remember Ether Delta did eventually get forked, but that's after it got sold. And then people were saying, the company that bought it was saying, hey, we're going to put a token in. If you don't hold this token, you can't list on Ether Delta. So someone's like, all right, I'm just going to fork it and call it Fork Delta. And then people can just list on there, which was quite funny.
Yeah, exactly. And that kind of shows to what you said earlier. I think people are more apt to fork out a useless token than they are some kind of small fee that's going to the team that's building out nice features.
Yeah, exactly. It's all just, I guess, incentives at the end of the day. So moving on, there's a bunch of various ETH2 updates I wanted to quickly go over. So it feels like ETH2 is maturing, especially the phase zero kind of part of it. It's definitely getting to a point where it feels like it's not just a bunch of people, you know, with a bunch of ideas sprawling around. We've got obviously testnets coming online from all the prominent companies that are building clients. We've also got the spec. The ETH2 spec got cleaned up this week in what Danny Ryan called like a spring cleaning. So basically maturing it a lot more and literally just cleaning up the code base essentially and cleaning up the spec as well. And we've also got June 30th as the tentative date for a spec freeze. So this basically means that the spec can't be changed anymore. And I know the client teams will be very happy with this because the spec has been changed a lot over the last few months. And, you know, as we know, it actually just got changed in the last week with Vitalik proposing increased validator rewards. So yeah, June 30th is the current deadline, which is, I guess for me, it's May 1st today. So yeah, 2 months until the spec is frozen, and that is it for phase zero, I think. You know, don't quote me on that. Maybe it can be unfrozen. I'm sure that it, you know, it's not frozen and that's it. It's not immutable, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it feels like it's getting close for sure, right? Like initially, you just brought up the issuance rewards and the economics. I remember the researchers initially said, hey, we'll kind of wait until we think the spec's pretty much final to kind of take all the community input and then eventually kind of tweak them. And, you know, that just happened. So I think we're getting close. Testnets are launching. And they're kind of dripping out by the day from the various client teams that are out there. Everything seems pretty solid. Of course, the second you get to a testnet, right, you kind of never know what's going to show up. But it seems like the teams are, you know, crushing it at this moment. And I don't know, I guess both of our original targets kind of has been end of 2019, more likely Q1 2020 for the phase zero mainnet launch. And I don't really see any reason to not think that's going to be the case right now.
Yeah, we're definitely on track for that, I think. I won't say that I think it's going to be the end of this year. Like, I'm hoping it is, but, you know, just to play it safe, there might be unforeseen consequences, or, you know, there might be more testing needed, so maybe early next year. But regardless of that, we have ETH 1.x being built in parallel. We have Layer 2 being built in parallel. It's not like ETH 1.0 has just stopped and, you know, we're waiting for ETH 2. Not at all. And I think I see a lot of frustration from various devs actually working in the space that people are putting too much emphasis on ETH 2 and not enough on ETH 1.x. That's definitely something that we've tried to reconcile. We've spoken about this before. We've tried to reconcile this on ETH Hub with the ETH 1.x page. You know, we've both put out tweet threads about this. So yeah, it's very important to understand that actually some of the things in ETH 1.x are critical to ETH 2.0 as well, such as state rent and EWASM. They're going to be going into ETH 2.0. Not sure which phase. I think state rent might go into phase 3, which is still a while away. But EWASM is definitely going to go into phase 2, I think, from memory, because you need that to do the state transitions between the shards and everything like that. So, I encourage people, if you don't know what ETH 1.x is, go read the page on ETH Hub. That's going to be the best explanation for you. The TLDR is it's a bunch of upgrades for ETH 1.0 to keep the chain chugging along while we work towards ETH 2.0. And it also allows for a bit better scaling on ETH 1.0 as well. But of course, we have more layer 2 tech for that coming out every day, like state channels and plasma and you know, side chains and all that fun stuff. And we have all the network effects on ETH 1.0. So not only are these other competitor chains competing with the future of ETH 2.0, but they're also competing with ETH 1.0 and 1.x. So they're kind of, I guess 1.x is basically going to usurp 1.0, but they're competing with two chains with a rabid community around it, with a huge amount of network effects built up over the years. I don't think that anyone stands a chance at this point of you know, coming and eating ETH's lunch. Maybe if ETH 2.0 takes too long to deploy and there's constant delays and things like that, which I don't think is going to happen, maybe. But as I said, we don't need to rely on ETH 2.0 because we have all the network effects and all the building already happening on ETH 1.0. We have layer 2 tech. We have all the upgrades coming. So just something to keep in mind, basically, that I know that a lot of people have been frustrated about lately that all this emphasis is being put on ETH 2 and not enough on 1.x.
Yeah, for sure. I think the Berlin meetings that happened for a couple weeks ago for the Istanbul planning did a lot of good for 1.x. It seems like we're getting a lot of more kind of awareness and popularity around it, and people are starting to step up to kind of take the leads on certain working groups and things like that for 1.x. So fully agree with you. I also fully agree that, you know, ETH 2.0 to me is definitely going to happen, and it's extremely important. Proof of stake, especially to me, is a very important aspect and one of the original reasons I got into Ethereum. But, you know, it's not, the future of Ethereum is not dependent on ETH 2.0. We could survive with 1.x and layer 2. So we need to make sure that we don't abandon those efforts and, you know, of course, put all our eggs in one basket, as they say it, because, you know, and like you just said, a lot of the 1.x stuff is valuable for 2.0 too, and stuff that we're going to need there and we'll learn from. So definitely we should put as much importance on the two efforts, because I think they're both vitally important.
Yeah, I think another critical thing to mention is, as you said, the working groups are coming together now. Alexei's doing a really good job of putting working groups together. And we'll talk about this in a sec. There's a working group for the new fee market proposal. But there's also a working group that was put together for using the Beacon chain to checkpoint the ETH 1.x chain, which would actually be a kind of like, I wouldn't call it a hybrid consensus. It would be the proof of stake Beacon chain, checkpointing the ETH 1.x chain, which means we could actually lower the proof of work rewards on the ETH 1.x chain, which would actually obviously cause the hash power to drop, but security to still stay about the same. So yeah, it's important to remember that the two kind of can work in harmony as well. I hope that we get this disintegrated where the checkpointing happens. But yeah, the working groups are just getting formed now, and there's a lot of research and development, but I think the team is motivated enough and intelligent enough to get this done, basically. Yeah, so moving on to the working group about the fee market, I'll let you cover this, Eric, since it's your little baby.
Yeah, definitely. So interestingly enough, tomorrow's episode features Rick Dudley, and we talk a decent amount about not only ETH 1.x, but we talk about the fee market changes as well using EIP 1559. So kind of a perfect little transition there. But yeah, so a working group was put together. So I guess stepping back a little bit, Vitalik presented the EIP at these Berlin-Istanbul talks. I put out a tweet yesterday with a link to that video and the deck he presented. So if you're interested in checking that out, just go back a couple days in my feed and or a couple tweets in my feed and give that a look. From there were a lot of discussions. It was a couple day meeting. It seemed to be pretty positive feedback on the fee market. There's a lot of very talented individuals that are interested in it and interested in being part of the working group. Rick stepped up and then plans to lead that working group. So a lot of good progress there. They're still trying to kind of, Rick says on the podcast, an EIP is not a spec, so they kind of have to transfer it into spec form, see the full scope of it, and then from there, put some test plans and development efforts behind it. So I know they're still looking for some development help there, some testing help, and, with that potentially goes some funding help too. And I know that was one of the concerns brought up at the Berlin meetings. I've said, whatever they need as far as, getting the word out there for help on the developer and testing side, or, even potentially helping to raise some funding to bring that all together, I'm willing to help with. And us at ETHUB, we're definitely willing to help with that because we think that this is an extremely important thing for, not only the user experience. There's so many benefits to this. The user experience is huge. We totally kill economic abstraction because we'd be burning ether, which lowers the issuance every year as well, which strengthens, the store value narrative and ether as money. And there's also a lot of benefits, on the technical side as well, that are involved in the ETH 1.x efforts. And Alexei is very interested in this because of that. So I strongly encourage, if you're interested in this, go check out the thread on Ethereum Magicians to start. If you're, a developer, a tester that maybe has a little bit of bandwidth, go check out the working group threads or reach out to Rick or Alexei or myself or whoever it might be. And, I know they're looking for help and people that get involved in this. So definitely do that if you're interested.
Yeah, and one note as well, this will actually get integrated with ETH 2. So yeah, it's part of 1.x, I guess you could say. I guess everything that's being developed on the 1.0 chain, layer 2 or layer 1, can be considered 1.x at this stage, since it's basically being rolled up into that from what I've seen anyway.
Yeah, definitely. I guess 1.0 is technically like today and in the past, and any future changes are going to be 1.x. There's a little bit, it's kind of weird how we use the two terminologies, but yeah, technically anything moving forward would be 1.x. And definitely this would go in initially on the 1.x side, ideally through Istanbul, which is, I guess, a bit of an aggressive timeline because it's 3 months, but I really hope it happens. But this would definitely be integrated into ETH 2.0. And when Vitalik and Justin kind of put in their GitHub requests the other day for increasing the rewards, as a part of that, they had some analysis on how much ether could potentially be burned through this EIP2. And in doing that, you obviously lower the network issuance, which is great. So very bullish on this idea, and hopefully it comes to fruition.
Yeah, and with the working group, we'll obviously get all the details, shaken out and any issues or anything. Rick's going to be an awesome guy to have on that, so I'm looking forward to seeing it evolve. So moving on, stability fee raise again for MakerDAO this week. So it got raised to 16.5%. I think the stability fee is finally doing its job. The DAI supply is now at about 84 million. There are a few big CDPs wiping a bit of debt. I know 3228 last time I checked is pretty much, I don't know if it's 3228 swan song, but like at this point, they have wiped so much debt that they've gone from 45,000 ETH of collateral to 12.6K. I just looked now. And their outstanding debt is down over half as well. So yeah, stability fee definitely doing its job. It's sad to see that it's gone up this high. I know a lot of people in the community are quite, I guess you could say, salty about it, which is fine because I guess maybe in general the community could have been more clearer about this being able to happen. I actually didn't know it could happen this fast. Like, I didn't anticipate. I mean, obviously I knew like the stability fee could be raised or whatever, but I didn't think that it would happen this fast. And I think that's what it caught a lot of people off guard. I'm not sure if there's another raise on the cards. I think there might be, considering that the peg still doesn't seem to be restored. Last time I checked, it was hovering at about, I guess, what is it? I can check right now. I think it was about 97 or 98 cents still, which is what it's been hovering around. Yeah, it's about 98 cents. So it has kind of recovered a little bit. It usually hovered around 96 to 97. But yeah, so it's weird. I expect to see another raise happen. I don't know how far, because this raise is only from 14.5 to 16.5, whereas the previous one was a 3% raise, and before that it was a 4% raise. So they've obviously slowed down with how much they want to raise it by. So maybe the next one is just a 1% raise, because that's all they need to do. But I do definitely trust the Maker team and their risk team and what they're doing and how they're handling this. Maybe they burn a few people in the short term, but at the end of the day, the product is still very good. The fundamentals of the entire system haven't really changed, in my view. This is just what we have to do until we get something like the DAI savings rate and multi-collateral DAI, which is coming. Like, they're shipping updates every day to testnet. I think the only thing keeping them from launching is like regulatory stuff, from what I've seen. So yeah, I really hope that we launch this soon, because it would make it a lot better for a lot of people who seem to be complaining about the stability fee raise. You know, it would help DAI a lot in keeping its peg. It wouldn't just rely on ETH for collateral either. So yeah, looking forward to that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess finally it's getting close to the peg. We pretty much talk about this every week. I still don't think the optics of this are great, but it seems like, you know, obviously Maker's one of the most talented teams out there. They have the most valuable dApp at this point on Ethereum. Just kind of classic, like, make sure you read the fine print before you get involved in any financial product. Like, I can't even imagine if this was like a traditional financial product that people weren't aware of how much the rate could swing, like the uproar that it would have caused. Luckily, you know, the impact's relatively small at this point. So it's always great to kind of learn about this stuff early on and kind of watch how the system could work. You know, the peg stayed pretty close to one over time, so I don't think there was really any systemic risk at all. You know, it's just still an inefficient market, right? And people are learning how the system actually works, and it'll definitely get more efficient as we get to multi-collateral DAI. I do think I had an interesting idea the other day. I'm a little shocked. Well, I'm not shocked, because it's still very early on, but I expect someone to put together some type of company that draws a very large amount of DAI and then manages the rate risk themselves. So essentially like a treasury function at a bank, and then offers kind of structured products at a bit of a fee to customers. So imagine this company draws 100 million DAI, let's say, in the future. That's obviously high right now, because that's essentially the cap which we're at. But let's just say they draw 100 million DAI onto their balance sheet, and they have ways to kind of predict the demand, the supply and demand for DAI, which you could arguably at this moment do just based on Ether price. So they're able to kind of have like a central management of their risk. And then from there, they have all this DAI and they can offer products to customers. So they could say, hey, you know, if you want a 12-month fixed rate, currently the floating rate is 5%, we'll offer this, you know, fixed rate to you at 7%. And I mean, I'm just making up numbers here, but they could take a little bit of cut on that that spread premium, right? So I'm essentially describing a bank, but I imagine that this is what's going to happen. I could see in 5 years' time that it's very rare for individual people to go directly to CDPs to open and manage them. I think that people will go to kind of a centralized isn't the right word, but maybe it is in this case, but some kind of entity that's taking on that rate risk and just offering better structured products to customers. Because I don't think, the reality is, people don't want that uncertainty in their rates. Like, there's a reason that the 15 and 30 year mortgage are the most popular mortgages in the United States, right? Or definitely across the world, definitely, but especially in the United States. But you know, even people start to get a little antsy when you talk about like a 5-1 adjustable mortgage, which is fixed for 5 years and then adjust once a year after that, right? Let alone daily fluctuations in debt. So I think there's a lot of lessons that were learned here, and I actually expect it to spur some new unique ideas and products.
Yeah, we've been talking about this amongst ourselves over the past few days, just because Maker, as you said, is kind of the biggest project on Ethereum right now. It's kind of the darling, and want to look at different ways that they can kind of, or that anyone can monetize, you know, something, create a business around Maker, and you just outlined a lot of them there, which is really cool. I think one of the big things with Maker or with this space in general is that crypto moves a lot faster than a traditional financial system, basically. So as you were saying, the rates for the CDPs have changed very rapidly. This can of course happen in the real financial system, the legacy financial system as well, but it doesn't happen as fast because it's just like a bigger beast at the end of the day. I fully expect when something like Maker would, if something like Maker gets to the same size as a commercial bank or something like that, or a central bank, right? It would not change this much because there'd be different levers that they could pull. There's obviously a lot more demand, a lot bigger economy as well. So I think this is just a function of being too early, not too early, but like being early, right, in the space. And diluting its peg is definitely a consequence of that. And as you said, it tends to follow ETH's price movements a lot too. We saw that DAI got back to its peg when ETH spiked up the other day quite heavily, but that was obviously because of increased demand, but the demand didn't last because the ETH price didn't keep mooning, basically. We can't rely on that. And that's why we've got multi-collateral DAI in the pipeline and the DAI savings rate to act as additional levers and not just rely on ETH price movements to restore the peg, basically. So speaking of MakerDAO, Cyrus, Maker's risk management lead, put out a really, really good tweet thread this week that I thought was it kind of goes back to a means Ethereum needs to go into war mode. The Ethereum community needs to go into war mode. So basically, Cyrus outlined that it's kind of funny watching, the broader crypto community ignore what's happening on Ethereum. He called it the Ethereum-shaped elephant in the room. And this is very true. We go on about this a lot, especially on Twitter. There is so much happening on Ethereum that people are just ignoring, whether that's out of bag bias or whether they just don't, they don't care about Ethereum or they don't feel a part of that community. I guess that's fine if you don't feel a part of the community or you feel like you don't identify with the community members. But the amount of crap that just gets spewed, I mean, this is why Ether was born, right? There's so much happening on Ethereum. He goes on to say, shady stablecoins have been a scam for like ages, and now we have DAI, right? Which is very transparent. You know exactly what's happening with it. We have so much base layer innovation happening on Ethereum with proof of stake and sharding, with privacy tech, with layer 2 scalability. Yeah, he just goes on and outlines all this stuff happening like in all the different areas of crypto. It was quite funny reading that thread, reading all the replies to it. But and his thread actually got quote tweeted a lot by Bitcoiners in general, saying, this is all crap. This is just snake oil, blah blah blah. Because one platform can't solve everything. But that's not what Ethereum's claiming to do. We're not claiming to solve everything. We're just working on as many things as we can at once, and then eventually we'll converge on what the best solution is instead of relying on panaceas, which is what a few different communities seem to do.
Yeah, I know. It's a great. I mean, I couldn't agree with this more. Right? It's kind of, in my opinion, more like missed out syndrome. I think a lot of people missed out on ETH. I know a lot of VCs missed out on ETH and kind of missed this wave. Everybody was fascinated with Bitcoin and kind of slept on Ether. And it happened so fast that not that many people got in early and found it, right? And got nice returns out of it. I think because of that, you're kind of seeing people trying to chase new products. And yes, the crypto market's going to be the crypto market, right? At least for the next couple of years, shitcoins are going to pump. Sure, some stuff's going to outpace Ether, but the reality of the situation is there's no indication that real development and community is fleeing out of the Ethereum space. And there's so many solutions out there for all of these common problems, and we don't need to just create new chains and new products on these chains to solve them, right? Like the community wants to stay on Ethereum for now, and that's where these products are going to be built. So I fully agree with everything Sarah said. It's kind of just like trying to find a problem that doesn't really exist, right? The real problem is the challenge in creating these applications and solutions, right? I mean, ETH 2.0 is not, no one else is doing this properly. It's a very challenging solution to create proof of stake, create sharding on a blockchain, all the way down to just the simple applications, applications such as stablecoins and decentralized exchanges. Like, these are complicated ideas that have a lot of problems to solve. And just because you launch a new chain doesn't mean that you're magically going to solve them.
Yeah, exactly. And it goes back to network effects too, right? Ethereum has all the network effects. So that's why everyone's building everything on Ethereum. Like, why would you build on somewhere else where no one's going to use your product, where, no one really cares about your chain? There's a lot of chains that are kind of dubious at best, not scams, but maybe just not really, I mean, it doesn't make much sense. I guess that's what Bitcoiners say about Ethereum, but objectively, or as objective as I can be about it, I can say that Ethereum definitely is not that, from what I've seen being in the community for as long as I have, and you've been in it longer than I have. And, you know, there are very legit people that in Ethereum, and the community doesn't act like some of these other rabid communities that I think are part of the more dubious projects. So yeah, as being as objective as I can, I definitely think Bitcoin and Ethereum are the only things that matter in this ecosystem right now, in terms of network effects at least, but also in terms of, I guess, innovation too. But at the end of the day, there is innovation happening on other chains as well. But I mean, this has been a Bitcoin meme for a while that Bitcoin would absorb any technology that the other chains came up with, but that's not going to happen, obviously. So I think Ethereum is actually going to absorb any of the good technology from other chains or other projects not building on Ethereum and just integrate it into the base layer, basically.
Yeah, does this make us Ethereum maximalists? I'm not sure what makes Ethereum maximalists these days.
There are a few people trying to coin that term, and I do not like Ethereum maximalist term because I still am a fan of other projects. Like, I don't just do Ethereum. Like, obviously, we're all in on Ethereum, but I do monitor other projects, and I don't think everything's a scam, which seems to be a prerequisite to being a maximalist.
Yeah, exactly. Being pro something and wanting it to win doesn't make you a maximalist. It's very different. So I'm joking with that, but at the same time, I'm not, because I'm kind of tired of that people bringing that up.
Yeah, exactly. I do want to quickly just read this one tweet from the thread by Cyrus. I quoting here, "The only nonsense that detractors keep spewing is more completely debunked claims about sinking a node and voodoo monetary policy. Overblown propaganda trash coming straight to you from the people who are still stuck in 2012. Now, that's a really funny tweet. Like, I almost laughed reading that. I think that kind of encapsulates the entire thread, or like the vibe of the thread and the vibe of the community as well, that a lot of this stuff is just so tired and so old, and like, just move on. It's like Bitcoiners have seen that, you know, there's nothing bad. Well, not bad, but there's nothing that they can really criticize anymore. Because Ethereum has grown so much that they're just criticizing all this old stuff, like the voodoo monetary policy or sinking a node. And of course they criticize ETH2 as well and say sharding's never going to work, but you know, we know that sharding will work. And then they say proof of stake's not going to work. Well, hello, we have so many different proof of stake chains live at the moment. You know, yes, they have different architectures to Ethereum, but to say they don't work is just beyond stupid at this point. So yeah, I'm glad that Cyrus has joined the army on Twitter, because he's been a bit, I guess, politically correct, you know, for various reasons, but he definitely has joined the fight, the good fight. Cool. So that's everything for this week. Thank you everyone for listening. If you don't subscribe to the newsletter, of course, go to ethhub.substack.com. Go to the podcast.ethhub.io to subscribe to the podcast, and we'll see you all next week. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to the Into the Ether podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at econoar and at Zazzle0x.